Hello and welcome to the world-famous and award-winning Driving You Crazy podcast. This is the show where we talk about all things transportation, anything that gets you from here to there. I'm the traffic anchor and the transportation reporter for Denver 7 News, Jason Luber. If you would like to be on the show, if you would like to contact me, you sure can. We have a listener hotline for you to call 303-832-0217, and all my contact information is in the description of the show. The other day, I received a press release from AAA Colorado, but it was a little unusual. It said that AAA did a study along with Bread Financial and found that younger generations are in greater numbers going on live event travel. Well, I thought that was fairly interesting. I also thought it would be a good time to talk about summer travel and the summer travel forecast and gas prices and that forecast and all the other issues that are on AAA's radar. So I invited AAA's expert extraordinaire, Skylar McKinley, to be here on the show. Skylar, his official title is Regional Director of Public Affairs for AAA Colorado, and he joins me now. Skylar, thanks so much for being here again on the world-famous and award-winning Driving You Crazy podcast.
You know, it's always a pleasure to be here, and I will say I'm not an expert on anything, but I'm really good at faking it, and I'm really grateful to you and your audience for giving me the time to do just that.
Oh, no, you are an expert. At least you sound like an expert that we all know and love. All right, so you're it's been a minute actually since we've talked. So, how are you? How's AAA? How's the bar?
Things are going well. AAA, we're actually adding a fourth A. Big announcement. No, I'm kidding. We've had a really busy legislative session. I will say from a AAA perspective, as you know, the past couple years have been really deadly on our roadways. And I think if there's any plus side to all of those tragedies, it's that the legislature, the governor, and others have taken roadway safety really seriously. So we've been had a very busy couple years with the legislature. People are talking about the issues that you and I think about every day, from, you know, failure to merge properly to people speeding and running red lights and the like. And then the bar is going well. I'm up there less and less this time of year because I'm busy at the legislature, but we're looking ahead to the end of session coming up in a couple weeks, and then hopefully some more time in the high country for me and probably everybody who's been busy in the building these past few months.
Yeah, I think we're ready for snow to end around here and for the snow to end up there to get to it. So I want to talk more about some of that legislative stuff here in just a little while, but I know that you're a music lover. I know that you have traveled for a bunch of concerts and shows. When AAA looked at travel for concerts, how far did someone have to go for it to be considered travel?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so you're right. I've traveled all over. I like to follow around what's left of the Grateful Dead. I've seen them in California. I've seen them in New York State, New York City, Texas, all over the country. I've gone to 40 plus shows across really the country in every state you can think of. We knew this was going on. We knew, you know, I knew anecdotally that I was doing it. I know there are folks in your newsroom who just got back from seeing Phish in Las Vegas at the Sphere. People do this, but we were curious as to the extent and how it broke down. So in our data, we use this sort of 50 miles or more metric. That's the same metric that we use when we calculate Memorial Day travel, when we calculate Labor Day travel, July 4th travel, because that's 100 miles round trip. So it's a planned trip. It's not like I'm gonna just get up and go. You do have to plan it a little bit. But what's interesting in this research is that, you know, it's not just folks driving 50 miles to see a concert, as we saw perhaps when Taylor Swift was in town in the Rocky Mountain West and folks from all over came in. People are flying. We know in our data, for example, that nearly 2 in 5 Gen Z and millennial travelers have spent between $500 and $5,000 on tickets alone. That certainly can be concert tickets, but we've seen them do this for comedy shows. We've seen them do it for live sporting events. In the survey, folks talk about doing it ahead of the Olympics. What's interesting is that especially with regard to younger demographics, we know 3 in 5 Gen Z and millennial respondents have done this, and they do this regularly. That's compares to about 43% of Gen X, about 27% of baby boomers. So younger generations do this often, in part because I think there's a bigger fear of missing out among members of those generations. And I think they are less likely, given the state of the economy right now, to want to save up for home ownership or to think something like that is viable. And so they're spending money on experiences instead.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now I want to go back to the travel for just a second. But in that survey, as you said, the older folks like me, Generation X and you know, the parents, the baby boomers, the older folks. If we took this survey 40 years ago, I'm sure they would say they did as much traveling to a show then as maybe the young kids do now. So is this something that just all young kids like to do, no matter what generation they're in or what time they're in? It's just young people like to go more than old people like to go.
That's a great point. And that was my gut reaction when I first saw it, too, is that this has been going on for time immemorial. Yeah, I think younger generations are less likely to have the connections that keep them stuck at home, right? So less likely to have kids, so they'll need to find someone to sit, less likely to have a career that's demanding to the extent that they can't leave for a long weekend, or they might feel bad about that. I think what's different when we look at sort of the Gen Xers and the baby boomers who did the same thing when they were young people, I think it's gotten a lot more expensive. So it used to be you could spend, you know, $5 to see the Grateful Dead, and then you could spend $5 to see the next show, and you probably could sell grilled cheese in the parking lot and pay for your ticket and your gas and your travel. Now, what's new, really in the past 15 to 20 years, concerts are expensive. Concerts aren't really affordable anymore. So the sacrifice that you have to make to go to a show, especially to travel to a show, is much steeper. And I think you have to be more deliberate to that end. So that's the only thing that's changed generationally is, you're right, young people will always do that. And yeah, we'll do the survey again in 20 years, and Generation Alpha will be the folks who are doing it. But I think what's changed is the amount folks are willing to and have to spend to make it happen.
Yeah, and you say, obviously, they have to spend a lot more now. And I think maybe within the inflation, yeah, you're selling grilled cheese for maybe a quarter. Now you can maybe get $5 for a grilled cheese, but yeah, then your ticket's costing you $500, right? So, I mean, especially if you want to go with a group, maybe you go in on one hotel room, but a lot of folks are like going to Coachella or whatever, and they're just camping out. So maybe they're saving money that way.
Yeah, that's right. And look, this was fundamentally a financial survey. And so we asked people, you know, why they go and fear of missing out and wanting to spend time with their friends. That sort of leads the pack. But about half the respondents who say they're not going say that the ticket costs are too high, that the travel costs are too high. And those are the primary reasons they won't go. I think relatedly, 40% of folks who go will say that they're worried about budgeting or debt they might incur as a function of it, or their inability to take off work. So there are a lot of reasons that folks don't do this. And in fact, among all the people who aren't doing it, it's because it's so costly, which I think anybody who's bought concert tickets in the past 5 years will tell you is absolutely the case.
Yeah, it's part of that reason. And we've heard about, you know, the legislatures, you know, National Congress going after Ticketmaster. Is that part of the problem here? I remember, goodness, it was 35 years ago about Ticketmaster being a fraud. So, I mean, is that part of the issue? Maybe there's not enough sellers of tickets out there. And is that changing? Could that be changing? It always seems like, what was it? Pearl Jam was a big leader in that back in the day, and then they caved.
Yeah. Look, I'm not an expert on this beyond just being a consumer like everybody else, but here's what I know. You know, there's probably not enough competition in the ticket market. Anybody who's bought a ticket for anything knows you're probably going to one of two websites if you're buying them direct for the show. And so lack of competition in most markets drives up costs for consumers. That's probably true for concert tickets. Then the other thing, and I will say this as somebody who buys a lot of concert tickets, is the dynamic pricing. And this survey goes into this, that there's this fear of missing out. So the tickets are always the most expensive when they go on sale, because everybody's worried they're not going to get a ticket. It's when they desire it the most. It's when demand is the highest. And a lot of people buy tickets right then. This is sort of the inverse of what we've seen with airline tickets, where you need to buy early. Now with concert tickets, if anybody asks, I say wait. Wait till closer to the show. Folks will have bought tickets and then be unable to go. That demand of the announcement and all the press and all the excitement will wear off. And the dynamic pricing, because these prices are algorithmically set based off how many people are logging onto the site to buy tickets at any one side time, that diminishes. You know, fear of missing out is a big driver of why millennials and Gen Z do these things. My advice to folks in those generations, and I'm one of them, is like, hey, just tap the brakes a little bit. You probably will be able to get a ticket. It's not the end of the world. You don't need a ticket on day one. You will find one before the actual event.
My guest is Skylar McKinley. He's the Regional Director of Public Affairs for AAA Colorado, talking about travel for concerts and shows and that sort of thing. And interesting, when you were talking about that, is that when the announcement for Billy Joel was coming to Denver to Coors Field, a very unique place. I like Billy Joel. He's one of the few people that I would like to go see in concert. And the tickets, when they were first going to come out, they were around $100 or so, or a little bit more. Now, and I'm thinking, all right, so if I take my kids then and my wife, then we're looking at $400+ just to get into the show. Plus, we're talking about parking. Plus, we're talking about getting, you know, do all of the stuff that you do at a show, right? So That's a lot of money. And then you look at the tickets right after they've been put, you know, everybody else is buying them right now when they first go on sale, and then they jack up the prices to $150, $200. And so, like you said, you wait, but I guess I just have to, if I don't find the right, if I don't get the right price, then I guess I'm just not going to go, and I'm going to miss out. I would like to go, but, you know, what am I going to do?
Yeah, look, I think that when we worked with Bread Financial on this release, we sort of looked into the general financials of folks doing this. And the big takeaway and my advice for anybody is set a budget. Look, we know you want to see Taylor Swift or Beyonce or Dead & Company or Fish or Billy Joel, and you have a right to. You should be able to, but set a budget and stay within that budget. And believe it or not, you probably will be able to. Now, that budget does need to be inclusive of everything, especially when it comes to event travel. So if you set, let's say you're going to travel somewhere and make a little vacation out of seeing your favorite act in some other city, and you set a budget of $1,000 total, you can probably achieve that. Yeah. But it means you have to get a good price on the tickets. You have to be reasonable when it comes to rental car. You might want to shack up at a friend's house or get multiple people, as young people do, in a hotel room. And setting that budget is really key, because otherwise, this sort of is that debt cycle that we see with folks where, you know, well, I'm going to spend $3,000 on tickets and another $2,000 on accommodations, and suddenly you have $5,000 in debt for one night.
Right.
You know, my personal financial status, that doesn't make sense for me. It doesn't make sense for most Americans. And so that's why you have to really take a step back, no matter how excited you are. And especially now, because these musicians are gargantuan celebrities, they set the culture. I mean, Taylor Swift, who just released a new record, is all anybody's talking about. And I'll give you an example. So I wanted to see the Stones coming up here in Denver, and I think they're playing at Ball Arena, or maybe they're playing at Mile High Field. But anyway, it's one of the big venues, and I got tickets, and the tickets were really expensive, but I got the tickets. And then it turns out my girlfriend can't go, so for her birthday, we're going to fly to Los Angeles to see them, so she gets the chance to see them. And the tickets were like a fourth of the price, and that's because we had waited, because I didn't buy on day one, because I didn't know I was going until, you know, weeks after. And we saved a lot of money, even adding in the cost of flying out there and spending, you know, a night in Los Angeles. It was still a lot cheaper.
And you get to, you know, a trip, like you said, it can be, you know, bundled into another adventure, which seems like it's fun. But I was wondering how many answers, how many of these respondents that you got answered to this survey, especially this year, because you keep mentioning Taylor Swift because of her concert. And so many people wanted to go see it in their town, but would travel for her specifically, not necessarily for some of the other acts. Obviously, there are some acts, like you said, that there are worth traveling for. But Taylor is a phenomenon.
Yeah, I would say the reason that we're doing this survey now, and I would suspect we're going to do it in years future, is that Taylor Swift and Beyonce really changed the game. These are huge cultural entities. They're an economy all of their own. And look, folks have been following around Fish and the Grateful Dead for years, and it never really hits that zeitgeist. But I remember being interviewed by folks at your network when Taylor Swift was coming to town, just asking me, what's this going to mean for traffic? Tell us where to park. And to the extent that, you know, reporters have to call up AAA to figure out how Taylor Swift is going to affect traffic means that, you know, something bigger is going on than your average concert. And I think that's what's changed, is the rise of these mega acts, and these mega acts touring is what's really inspired people to spend a little more to travel around. And look, I will say, just sort of relatedly, we're so lucky to live in Denver. Everybody stops through here. It's just where we're located between Chicago and LA. We get all the big acts. We get all the small acts. It's a great town for music. But let's say you lived in Bozeman, right? Where are you going to go? Let's say you lived in Cheyenne. Let's say you lived in Albuquerque. You have to come here.
Yeah.
So lots of folks will travel to Denver as a function of these acts coming through here in a way that I guess, you know, you and I don't have to think about, because it's like, well, Billy Joel's going to be in our backyard. So at least it's just the concert tickets, not also a, you know, a $500 night hotel room.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because as you keep saying, it's a financial survey, really. And so are these kids in just more flexible jobs than I had when I was younger? Are they able to get more time off? Or are they able to just leave whenever they want? And it seems that they're not saving like others, like we used to when at least I was younger, for the rainy day or for the future. It seems like it's buy now, spend now, earn now.
Yeah. Great question. So look, in our survey data, they do worry about that. They worry about missing work. They worry about their inability to budget. They worry about mounting credit card debt. But the desire to go to these concerts, to these sporting events, just outweighs that. Here's what I would say generally, what we know about these generations. They are a little, they're still working hard. They're still part of the workforce, but they're probably less attached. So they're a little bit less worried that their boss might be mad if they take an extra day off. They're just going to take it. And you know, you and I have talked about this before. I actually think that's the right mindset. It's called earned leave because you earned it. Take it. It's a benefit that your job gives you. Younger employees who are newer in their jobs are just less likely to care about the politics of whether or not they're taking leave. They're also less likely to believe that they have the ability to save up for sort of those financial staples, like a house or like a rainy day fund. They're generally a little bit more depressed about the state of the future. So they believe in investing in themselves now. So, you know, I think it's just that as the economy has changed, this has changed with those younger generations. And I think a related point is that Gen Z and millennial workers are probably also more likely to be in jobs that have some remote flexibility. Yeah. And so, you know, maybe you're flying out to Chicago or Las Vegas to see an act and the concert's at 7 and you get there at, you know, 11 a.m. You'll probably have a reduced workday virtually until the show begins.
Right. No, that's a good point. And I think people now aren't thinking that they're going to be in a job for like their father or their grandfather for 20 or 30 or 40 years. They're willing to jump around as they need to. If this job isn't giving them what they want, then okay, see ya. I'll go get a job over there or over there or over
right.
there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. My guest is Skylar McKinley. He's Regional Director of Public Affairs for AAA Colorado. We're talking about concert travel and event travel. How far are people willing to go? You said 50 miles was really the low limit. Is there a high limit on how far these people would go?
They'll travel the world over. So we know in the survey about 80% of travelers want to head to their like dream event location is the term that they use. So New York, Florida, and California are the top three states. They're states that people wanted to travel to anyway, and then they want to see a show while they're there. Las Vegas and Chicago are the top cities. And I will say, people will also plan their travel around specific venues. Madison Square Garden is a place that folks want to go. New is the Las Vegas Sphere, which is now doing concerts. Radio City Music Hall. Also places like Red Rocks Amphitheater. So folks are willing to travel pretty far distances. I think what happens here, and our survey didn't get into this, but for a lot of folks, they will. The tour will be announced, for example, for a musician, and they're going to go through the dates in the cities, and they'll probably do some internal calculus about like, well, I've never been there and I'd like to be there, or that venue is there and that's supposed to be a good venue, or my friend from college lives there and I bet he or she wouldn't mind if I crash on their couch for the night, which saves me the money there. So folks are willing to travel, and talking to people who do this, the first thing they buy are the concert tickets. The rest they figure out later. And they might not figure out the rest of it until months after. They might buy the concert tickets today because they want to see this event 1,000 miles away. And then, you know, 2 weeks before they're set to go, they might get plane tickets and a place to stay. And they sort of just figure it out as they go. And in that way, I guess it sort of reduces the financial hit, right? Because unlike paying for a cruise or even an all-inclusive vacation where you pay for everything, right, you know, as you book, you can do this in chunks. And, you know, that makes it easier to budget, at least.
I imagine the same is for international travel, too, because there are people that will go to Mexico or South America or especially Europe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've had friends who traveled to Europe to see Billy Strings, who's a, you know, on the rise bluegrass musician. He plays in the United States all the time. He plays in Colorado regularly, but they had never been to Europe before. And so they knew all their friends were traveling to see this show. And we really do see that bear out in the data, that this is used as a great excuse to visit places you wouldn't see otherwise. I'll give you an example. You know, years ago when I was following around the Grateful Dead, I would try to, my friend and I were a big history buff. We would try to pick out venues in cities where they had presidential libraries.
Oh, neat.
So as a function of following around the Dead, I also saw all of these presidential libraries that I would never have traveled to on my own just to see, but I'm in Austin anyway. Let's go see the LBJ Presidential Library and Museum.
Yeah, no, that's neat. That's really interesting. You know, and I'm always amazed at how many kids I see at major sporting events, like the Final Four was one of the more recent ones, or major college bowl games, right? I guess they like traveling for those things as well, right?
Yeah, and you know what's interesting too? Parents will bring kids, sporting events specifically, because sports become sort of tribal, right? So if you figure out a way that you and the entire family can go to some playoffs or some semifinals or, you know, something like the Super Bowl, you're going because you're a big fan of one of the teams that's playing, and you're hoping that your kids will be too. And remember, you know, as much as we've talked about millennials and Gen Z, millennials have kids. I mean, millennials are sort of the peak important spending demographic right now when it comes to being in their mid-30s to early 40s, having kids, but also having a little money to spend. That's the central driver of the economy. And so you will see some packages for these sports travel events and concert travel events that include a childcare component or that includes something for the kids to do. Some travel agents will build out itineraries and say, well, you're going to this. We know you're going to be at that concert that time, but the next day, try this children's museum. So I think my big takeaway is that travel in the United States and among Americans is seen as a right, not a privilege, and especially so because we have such affinity for the things that we like. Yeah. So if you are a Swiftie, if you really like the Redskins, you know, or I guess they're called the Commanders now, I should say, yeah. then that becomes part of your identity to the point where this is just money you would spend without question.
It almost seems that it's a mix. I don't know. It's like, do they like the travel more than they like the event, or is it vice versa, or is it just basically a 50-50 or somewhere a mash of in between there?
I think the event is the reason to go, but then once they're there, they always add on. Something like 70% of respondents say they add on extra time, so they treat it like a vacation. So nobody wants to be on a plane for several hours, to get off a plane, then immediately go to a crowded stadium, and then leave the stadium, go to bed, wake up, get on a plane, right? People go for several days. And I think it's easy to forget, we're a huge country. Yeah. Right. So there's a lot of places that are on Americans' bucket list that are within America, but it might be hard. You might not say like, well, I'm going to plan a trip to Dallas because you don't think of Dallas as a great sort of tourism city until you realize that there's something you want to see in Dallas. And then you say to yourself, well, I've always meant to go to Dallas, and you go.
Right. Well, is there a event or something that's on your bucket list? Is there something that you haven't seen yet that you want to go see?
I am going to the Sphere this time next month to see the Dead.
It is cool. It's a cool place.
Yeah, I can't wait for that. And then, you know, there's a lot of secondary venues that I really enjoyed. So, like, I went and saw a great show at the Isleta Amphitheater in Albuquerque, and that was an amazing show. And so that really inspired me. Like, we have a lot of smaller venues in Denver that sort of mainstream but smaller acts will play. Those exist in other cities. So now I'm thinking like, well, I'd like to go to some of these other cities and go to their small venues instead of the stadium shows, just to get a feel of like, you know, how does Minneapolis compare to Denver on the ground?
I was just thinking when you were mentioning Dallas, the Fort Worth Stockyards would be kind of cool to see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, something like
that. Yeah, exactly.
My guest is Skylar McKinley. He's the Regional Director of Public Affairs for AAA Colorado. One aspect of concert travel is how much money it takes to get there, whether you're flying or whether you're driving, and how much the gas prices are. Where are we now with in terms of gas prices, and what is the outlook for the summer, not only here, but really nationwide?
And nationwide, gas prices are fairly high where they should be this time of year. We're looking at about $3.68 at the national level. That's steep. That's noticeable. We've been living in an era of expensive gas related to what's going on internationally. 2 years ago, we hit the highest we've ever seen on record, and that was a function of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and Russian energy exports becoming persona non grata at an international level. We're still living through that. So, $3.68 nationally, this is the start of the summer driving season. There'll be some downward pressure right now, sort of as we're in this in-between period between spring break and summer vacation. But I always look at the prices in April as the launching pad for the rest of the year. So there will be increases and consistent ones at the national level in gas prices. In Colorado, there's good news and bad news. We have the second cheapest gas in the entire country right now. That's the good news, at $3.16. We're only 6 cents above the lowest, which is Mississippi. They're at $3.10. Cheap gas prices compared to what our neighbors are paying, cheap gas prices compared to what the rest of the country's paying. That's the good news. The bad news is this is not going to last for a variety of reasons. Number one, we're in our mud season, so prices have actually declined on the week in Colorado from when I, you know, last looked at this and we were the second lowest. We've gone down since then because the ski resorts are closed. Spring break is over. It is muddy in the high country. There's not a lot to do in Colorado in this period because it's not quite warm enough. We're still getting snowy days, but there's not enough snow to sustain skiing, right? So as things heat up and dry out, we're going to enter into our summer tourism season. We are a robust summer tourism economy. People come here. We go out and do things. All of that increases demand. That demand increase generally increases prices. And then sort of something that I'm very intimately aware of, and I'm sure you are, but Coloradans probably aren't thinking about yet, is that one, we're going to switch over to summer blend, which adds 15 cents on top of what we pay anyway. We do that every year. But this year's summer blend is different than summer blends in years past. We are switching over to what's called reformulated gasoline. This is because the ozone pollution on the Northern Front Range is so bad, as assessed by the EPA. It's among the worst in the country. We have most severe non-attainment status, that the EPA mandates that we go to a lesser polluting or lesser ozone impacting fuel called reformulated gasoline. We only have one refinery in the state of Colorado. So while it is only the Northern Front Range that is required to use this fuel, the whole state is going to have to buy it because it's what's going to be produced. And that can add anywhere, you know, some low estimates say that about 5 to 10 cents of price differential will be passed on to consumers. On the high end, I've seen 40 cents in some analyses. So when we switch over, expect to start paying a lot more than in summers past because our ozone pollution is so bad in our major population center.
Interesting. Well, do places like Cheyenne that are close to us get, or, you know, especially in speaking specifically Colorado, would they get gasoline from us from our refinery there in Commerce City? Is it a regional thing, as you said, or they wouldn't get this reformulated gas because they don't necessarily need it?
Well, they don't need it, first off, and they have other options in the marketplace. So sometimes Suncor gas makes it to Wyoming, but there's a lot of gas that's being piped in and through Wyoming, so they'll have access to other refined fuels. So it won't be regional, and there are parts of the state that will be a little bit immune, and I give that example as Mesa County. Mesa sometimes gets its gas from places other than Suncor. Different, you know, some portions of the Eastern Plains get gas from elsewhere. So, you know, there will be service stations that aren't selling RFG. You won't know it. It's not required to be labeled. The law says that if you're a retailer and you're in the impacted area, you must sell it. And the refineries produce what the retailers sell. Most of the state functionally, including, you know, the sort of I-70 mountain corridor, they're all going to be using RFG. It'll be more expensive. I mean, it's just, this is the new normal for us. People are surprised. I think people who don't live here and don't see the smog, my colleagues in AAA, I told my colleague in Chicago who they have to use RFG, and I told my colleague in Los Angeles they have to use RFG. I said, well, Denver has to go switch over to RFG, and they're like, what? But it's, the air is so clean there. You'd think as a state that cares about the outdoors, it's true, but also just the sort of weather patterns we have, plus the amount of ozone pollution we create, has, you know, that smog that you see on a bad day in Denver is what this is addressing.
My guest is Skylar McKinley, Regional Director of Public Affairs at AAA Colorado. Talk about gas prices. And do you see gas prices right now? As you said, we're in the threes, but that's not everywhere. Could you see that we're going to get into the four? I know, like the California, Hawaii, they're already over $4 or $5. Do you think nationwide we're going to be creeping up to that? Because that's $4 is like a magic number for a lot of folks that start freaking out.
Yeah, we know in our survey data, $3.50 is where people start really noticing gas prices, and they start thinking about how high they are. $4 is where they begin making behavioral adjustments, like carpooling or reducing trips. $4.50 is where they start changing a lot of their behavior and deciding just not to drive and not to road trip. There's, you know, if I could tell you where gas prices would end, I would not be in this job. I'd be, you know, working probably the stock market somewhere and making a lot more money. There's a lot of open questions. So I don't see the same level of alarm bells nationwide that I saw 2 years ago this time in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. At that point in February, I was telling people this is going to be the most expensive year we've ever had. Last year at this time, we were coming out of the Suncor refinery closure, and so our major source of production was gone. And I was telling folks, you know, as in January, this is going to be an expensive year for gas prices in Colorado. Now, looking at everything, demand is high. People still have a lot of faith in the economy. They're still spending money despite living in an era of high interest rates. Folks are still spending money, as we talked about, on travel and going out, and all of that impacts demand and supply. The good news is generally when you have high gas prices, it means that the economy is not collapsing. I think that, you know, by most expert accounts, we might have a soft landing with regard to high inflation without creating high unemployment. That's all good news. The open questions for whether we go north of $4, you know, I think $4 is probably within what we'll, reason what we'll see in Colorado this summer. I don't see that $4.50 number. I don't see us going, you know, steep north of $4. We might be in the range.
But there's a lot of turmoil in the world now. I mean, you mentioned Russia earlier, but there's a lot of bad stuff happening in the Middle East right now.
Yeah, and that's why the oil markets are very scared right now. And some of the price increases we've seen lately have become, are a function rather of the fact that the oil markets are scared. Here's what I would say. Iran is the third largest producer, for example, of global oil, but it's the third by a big stretch. It produces, I think, 20% on a daily basis of what the number one producer, Saudi Arabia, produces. Iraq produces more than Iran. And globally, because of the sanctions that the United States specifically has put on Iranian exports, Iranian oil does not have the impact that Russian energy exports, for example, would. So right now, the conflict in the Middle East, to the extent that it impacts the oil market, involves Iran and Israel, neither of whom are major producers with regard to what we use in the United States. Now, if that becomes a regional conflict, if that were to grow, if other Arab nations were to engage, if the entire region becomes embroiled in war, if it becomes unsafe to ship oil in and around the region, yeah, prices could really skyrocket. You see some oil analysts saying that, but the folks that I trust and the folks that I talk to, they are not sounding those alarm bells yet. So anything could happen, as we saw, 2 years ago with Russia. But right now, I'm not seeing the doom and gloom $5 and $6 per gallon scenarios that some more, let's call them bellicose analysts are looking at.
And that would lead me to think that a lot of people then would, especially for the summer, as they're continuing to get farther and farther from the old COVID, that we're ready to get back onto our summer road trips and get back into that routine of hitting the road and getting an RV or doing whatever. So if the gas prices are within range, we should see a pretty decent summer driving season then.
I expect this might be, just based off the travel bookings we've seen in our travel data, based off our survey data. We 2019 was like a banner year for travel. It was the highest we've ever seen in all of our data at AAA. And then, of course, 2020 was one of the worst years we've ever seen. And in the years since, we've seen demand pick up, but still haven't quite reached those 2019 levels. By most estimates, I think that this will be the year that we surpass 2019. And so if there's a line in the sand where the travel economy is back to normal, this is the year. I think the travel economy has changed. And so what we've seen since the pandemic is if folks are more likely to take off some shoulder days around long weekends. Yeah. So instead of planning a 2-week trip to Yellowstone and they use up all their leave all at once, we've seen actually more travel that's shorter distance, but more frequent. So, I have a day off because of a long weekend. I'm going to add a day or two on either side of it. We're going to go on a 5-day vacation. That has become way more prevalent since the pandemic, because during the pandemic, the state and national parks were really the only way to travel. And yeah. So folks really availed themselves of outdoor excursions because they couldn't, spend a lot of money to spend several days at Disneyland. They had to sort of self-lead vacations. So it's going to be a big travel year. If we get in that nightmare scenario where gas is $4.50 or $5, that will impact behavior and that will lead to a diminution in demand. But if demand falls, then prices will fall too. So it's unlikely we will see high prices and sustained demand. More than likely, they'll hit an equilibrium as they always do. And I would say, though, for folks who are road tripping and we're not too far out from Memorial Day, which is the start of road trip season, right now we have cheap gas in Colorado, and we have relatively cheap gas if you go southeast of us or northeast of us. If you're traveling anywhere west of us, it's high prices. So California is $5.45, Oregon is $4.45, Washington is $4.65, Idaho is about $4, Utah is about $4, Arizona is $4.15. So just budget for that. So many Coloradans drive westward. Yeah. When we leave the state, and so if you're doing that, just budget. A couple of years ago, relative to our concert travel conversation, I drove from Denver to San Francisco to Denver and back to see the Dead. And that was when we hit the historically high prices in 2022. So like I was paying, $6 in California for gas. And I was just spitting mad at myself for not timing out my trip better, so I didn't have to fill up in the most expensive state when I most needed it.
That's like me getting caught in a traffic jam.
Yeah, well, exactly. I can imagine your frustration.
Yes.
As I always say, you can't be mad at traffic. You are traffic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're right. Even though I talk about it all day long. My guest is Skylar McKinley, Regional Director of Public Affairs at AAA Colorado. And with the higher gas prices, that can lead to higher fares for flights. But it still seems like a lot of folks are flying, because our airport, Denver International, is now, I think the third busiest airport in the world or something like that. So there's a lot of people flying.
Yeah, DIA is relatively in the top five. It sort of fluctuates. I know last year it was number three busiest. You'll also see at DIA that they're really aggressively adding flights. For example, by June 11th, Turkish Airlines will have a direct from Denver to Istanbul. It's a 12-hour flight. It's the longest flight you can take from Denver. That, for us as folks who live in Denver, I think we sometimes forget the convenience of being able to just hop on a plane and go wherever we want without having to transfer. But it really is great to live at a place that has a major hub. And then I think, relatedly, having all of these direct flights internationally is key for us. It has put Denver on the map economically as a travel center, even among my AAA peers. And we talk about travel every day with reporters across the country. We're all talking about the rise of DIA. So it's a cool thing that we have. If you haven't been to the airport recently, know that if you're planning summer travel, it probably will be a much smoother experience. We've got new security lanes open. A lot of that Great Hall construction, it's still going on, but it's been tempered a little bit. For many years, people like to knock our airport as being a mess and chaotic, and it is. But it's still, relative to every experience I've had there, an amazing airport to travel through. I always am able to take the train to the plane, and it's probably my favorite airport, really, to fly in and out of, except for DC National in DC,
They have
just
new
because of
they
its
have new
transit
trains
capability.
inside the airport too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is the most significant piece of the Colorado economy, if you ask me, and we're continuing to invest in it as if it powers the entire state, because it does.
And the growth out there is tremendous. All the homes and businesses, it's just really the tremendous growth around that airport, how many people are moving in, and all the developments around here is really spectacular.
Yeah, and look, I would say that major corporations choose to locate their headquarters here or their regional offices because you can catch a direct flight from Denver to just about anywhere, and that is not true in other, even other major cities.
I had an interesting interview with a company called AirHelp. I don't know if you've heard of them. It was a few episodes back. And basically what they do is they help you recover money if your flight is delayed or canceled, but they do it mostly for European or international flights or those European travelers, because the rules there for European flights are different than they are here in the United States. I know there's been some talk about increasing our passenger rights. I mean, really, is it time for a United States passenger's bill of rights?
That's a great question. So Europe has really robust protections when it comes to delays, cancellations, and the like, to the extent that I've talked to European travelers who are shocked we don't have this in the United States. So I think good news and better news. Good news, the U.S. Department of Transportation very aggressively has taken action against major airlines and held their feet to the fire. So right now, on a voluntary basis, many of the major airlines are offering you some sort of benefit if your plans are waylaid by preventable delays or cancellations. Travelers can see what the airlines have committed to at flightrights.gov. And look, if anything happens to you, you've got a delay or cancellation, go to that website, see what they promised you. Remember, it has to be a preventable delay or cancellation. So bad weather is not something the airline can control. Bad staffing, where they don't have enough planes or people in the right places, is something they can
But how do
control.
I know if they're, I mean, look, let's say the weather is iffy, or some planes are coming in and some planes are not going out. So, I mean, sometimes it seems like the airlines are using the weather excuse to get out of helping me.
That is an interesting perspective, and I think probably a lot of people share it. To the extent that this is something that we need to make clearer, these right now are all voluntary on behalf of the airlines, and you're right, it's sort of self-policed, but the DOT is in rulemaking to establish what will functionally be a passenger bill of rights. And that will clearly delineate what is a preventable delay or cancellation and what isn't. A mechanical error, for example, always is if there's something that's wrong with your airplane. It also sets in statute, or sorry, sets in rule what a delay is. Right now, the airlines, a cancellation is a cancellation, and there's certain rights that kick in for a cancellation. But a delay, is what's known as a significant delay, has been left up for the airlines to interpret. And the airlines, of course, will always say, well, that's not a significant delay. DOT is in rulemaking right now to make a permanent rule that will functionally be a passenger's bill of rights. I know attorneys general across in Colorado and across the nation are working with the Secretary of Transportation on this. So it is happening. Will it be as robust as what they have in Europe? Probably not, just knowing the nature of how we do rulemaking. But it should be a lot better than it was a few years ago. This also came out of the pandemic. Remember, the airlines were bailed out functionally. And now they're having to pay that back in terms of at least giving passengers a more predictable experience.
Yeah, and members of Congress are flying all the time. So you would think that they are being impacted by these delays and cancellations even more so than the average flyer. So why have they not wanted to really take this up and run with it? Are the airport or the airline lobbyists that great?
I think that it's very easy to sort of blame the lobby. I'm a lobbyist.
Yeah,
I wish
right.
we had this sort of power. I just think that it's so complicated, right? So actual imposing airline rules and restrictions involve so many different actors and so many different parts of government that it's a monster piece of legislation. You can talk about, well, it's a passenger bill of rights, but when push comes to shove, it's not that the lobbyists necessarily are killing the bill. It's that, like, nobody's taking the time to read the bill.
Stopped them in the past.
Yeah. for all the pressing issues, it's not something that folks have sat down and looked at. Although, to some extent, there's a lot of motion right now on credit card fees and transaction processing fees. And you've got the leadership of the U.S. Senate on both sides taking an interest in that. And you also have, in that case, the airline lobby and airline rewards advocates really pushing back, because they would say, well, if we limit these transaction fees that the credit card processors can charge, we're going to take away your airline rewards. So these conversations are fluid. They're happening at all times. I think we're waiting probably to see what the DOT does. And then if Congress isn't happy with the DOT finalized rules on this, then there probably will be congressional action.
It's just so frustrating.
I will say this, though, and probably relatedly, if just thinking this through, the folks who can afford airline travel, they're not your working class, red meat sort of voter. And so, like, it's harder to say you're fighting for Americans when you're fighting for only those Americans who can afford to take a flight. And, while a majority of Americans have traveled by plane, only a minority do it regularly, right? Like, people who travel more than once a year or even a year on a yearly basis on an airplane, that is not the same experience that a lot of Americans have.
But still, they deserve the same rights as anybody doing anything at any time. I so feel so bad. And I was a parent, and I still am, I guess. so I guess that never stops. Of young kids and traveling, and it is the most frustrating. You have to try to plan for every possible outcome, whether your flight is going to be delayed or just canceled or all of the above all at the same time. So you have to pack snacks and food and all these different things to keep your kids entertained and happy, because that is very frustrating as a parent with kids, no matter real. Oh, I mean, it's easier when they're teenagers because they pretty much just want to stay by themselves, but especially with young kids. But I mean, I guess to your point, yeah, some people don't fly as much as others, but they still deserve the same rights as everybody else.
Yeah. Look, the pandemic, really, in the wake of the pandemic, everybody started talking about, and the airlines, remember, were short-staffed. They had to furlough a ton of workers. They weren't at capacity. And then all of a sudden, travel comes back and the airlines weren't ready. That's why everybody was steaming mad at the airlines 2 and 3 years ago. I think things have improved significantly since then. If you look at last Christmas travel period, for example, we didn't see the meltdowns that we saw previously. So things are improving. We'll see what the DOT does. And then I would say for folks with a platform like you, if for your listeners and your viewers, if you're mad about something the airlines did, check to see if they violated your rights. If they did, hold their feet to the fire. And if not, write your congressperson.
Yeah.
Because it really sounds cliche, but unless folks hear from people, they're not going to know it's something they need to act on.
As you said, that you are pretty much a lobbyist as well, and you're always advocating for driving safety and things like that. One of the problems that I've seen with driving safety is that people tend to speed a lot, and they are speeding all the time. There are roads here in Metro Denver and south of town that the speed limit's 75, but nobody goes 75. It's 85 or 90, 95, somewhere in there. So, and it doesn't seem like there's enough enforcement. When I was over in Ireland about a month or so ago, they had an interesting concept where they had it wasn't just a photo radar where it takes a picture of a license plate at one spot. It was a average speed. They had it in a tunnel over by the airport, but they also testing it out in other places along their highway. So they would take the picture of your license plate and your car at mile marker, let's say 1, and then again at mile marker 8, and they would take your average speed. And so that's the way to keep people from speeding over longer distances rather than just one spot. What do you think about that kind of an idea to help control or rein in some of the speeding problems?
Yeah, so I think you're exactly right. And I, as an occupational hazard, I never speed. I always go, the most I'm ever going is the speed limit. And you know, if somebody's in the car with me, they're always asking me why I'm going so slow. And I'm always feel like I'm about to be run off the road by people who are speeding when I'm just going the speed limit. So I think about this often. So, you know, automated enforcement in the United States is controversial because Americans believe, and sometimes it's true and sometimes it isn't, that basically that revenue that these speed traps are funding, you know, governments. And we've not seen that. There's a lot of guardrails in the United States that prevent that sort of automated enforcement. And that's the issue, is for what you're describing there, which sounds like a very effective piece of ABIS or automated enforcement technology, we probably have to specifically legalize it. Right now in Colorado, we've now tinkered with the law a few times where we've legalized red light cameras and speed cameras. That's all we've legalized, right? And in some cases, they have to be manned by law enforcement, otherwise they're not valid. Because in this country, we've decided that we don't like automated enforcement, and that's one reason why we have so many speeders. So I wish I had the silver bullet on this. I think technology like that would be great. We probably need more automated enforcement. But you and I are probably the only people out there saying, I wish more people would get more tickets for speeding, right? Most drivers, and most drivers don't speed, is what you'll find interesting. About only, you know, 85% of drivers generally try to do the right thing. They might speed a little. They might be in that 5 to 10 mile, you know, which is still significant, but it's not the 20 to 30 miles over the speed limit,
What was
right?
interesting is that they were citing that they had a compliance rate of less than for speeding. It was maybe 35 or 40% people were speeding before this program went into effect, and then they added a compliance rate of like 95%, where everybody was monitoring their speed a lot better. So yeah, you know, even though maybe not a majority of the people are speeding, the people who do still cause I guess angst for the people who are just doing the right thing.
Yeah, and they cause the fatalities and the crashes. And like I say this all the time, even if you don't care about traffic safety on a day-to-day basis like you or I might, you definitely think about it a lot every time you get your insurance renewal notice and your rates have gone up 10, 15, 20%. We are paying more in Colorado for insurance because we have more crashes and more payouts and we have unsafe drivers. I don't know what the easy solution is for something like speeding. Enforcement is increasing. The state patrol is staffing up. I think that it looks like the legislature is about to pass a handheld phone ban, which historically we haven't had that as primary enforcement, where you can actually now be ticketed for holding your phone while driving. Folks are getting more serious about traffic safety, but the culture change, what I try to tell people and my friends and my peers, if you see someone that you love driving poorly, you should really be mad at them. We already do this with drunk driving, where we take away people's keys, or we know someone drove drunk and we say, how dare you? You can't do that. That's unsafe. It's immoral. But for speeding or for holding your phone, red light running, California rolls at stop signs, we're less likely to chew out people we know and love, but we should, because we know the fatality rates. We know that 2022 was the deadliest year on our roads in history, and we know that it just like this individual behavior adds up.
What about this idea? I'm an idea guy, you know, Skylar. I'm just an I think about these things. So what about instead of the fines for somebody caught speeding going to the county or the state, what if the money went to a nonprofit of your choice?
That'd be a great one. I mean, as a traffic safety guy, here's what I would like to see: that if the money from tickets can't go to a city or state's general fund, it needs to go specifically into traffic safety. Because everybody will say, well, we don't have enough money to make this intersection safe or to put this lit signal here or to put a stop sign here. If you dedicate that fund to traffic safety, I think that improves it a little bit. There's also a sort of a far th option here that we would never do in America, but we could. We could just make it so your car can't speed. Cars are computers. We could literally have the manufacturers put a chip in your car that prevents it from driving faster than the speed limit. We are soon going to have mandatory DUI blows in cars that roll off the line starting in 2030. The DOT has mandated this. Congress has mandated this. We're going to have impairment detection in cars. That's coming in 2030 because we've decided drunk driving, there's no excuse for it, and the technology can prevent it in vehicle. We could do the same thing with speeding. We could have a chip in your car that just says, nope, we're not letting you drive 95 in a 70. But we don't have that. I think that will we have that someday? Yeah, if we don't get more voluntary compliance with speeding laws, then Congress will do what it just did with ignition interlocks and just mandate that cars have them rolling off the line.
That means people are just going to buy older cars, like you know, just drive those forever.
There's probably some truth to that. You know, Especially like EVs were such a huge thing this time last year, even where every manufacturer was saying, well, we're not going to produce internal combustion engines anymore. And, you know, I heard folks saying like, well, I'm going to buy up every internal combustion I can so that I never have to drive an EV. Yeah. You know, now EVs are, I think, not the vehicle du jour, but hybrid electrics are. And technology is always changing in these cars. But in America, you can always buy an older vehicle. If you were planning on buying an older vehicle so you can drive drunk, though, here's my advice. Don't.
Yes.
You will be caught, because guess what? Guess who the cops will be looking out for when it comes to drunk driving enforcement post 2030? It'll be the folks driving the 1985 Ford Thunderbird.
That's right. Oh, man. And I was thinking, what about the fines was another issue that I think could really change behavior, because if I'm going to get dinged for a speeding ticket that's I'm going 10 miles an hour over, and in the entire fine is going to be $36, something like that, it's not going to be as impactful as if it's going to be $360 or $3,600. The higher the fine, the more compliance you would, I think, would see.
Yeah, you know what? We still want to be mindful, though, of equity, right? So in that situation,
well, there's no equity in this, because if you don't speed, you don't get fined.
Agreed. And especially for repeat offenders, I think you'd want to have the fines significantly go up. We could also chain. We know what your income is. We could chain, because what would happen
is that
folks who are rich. Yes, right.
Or Finland, so something like that.
If we don't chain it at least to income somehow, then the folks who are wealthy will say like, well, $360. I love speeding. I'll pay $360 to speed, no problem. So you know, there's all sorts of reforms you could make. What's difficult is that we have a federation of states in the United States of America, right? That the states are all sovereign. You know, Congress has limited tools to get all states to do the same thing with traffic compliance. And not every state has an interest in doing this, which makes enforcement difficult. So there's, you know, driving culture in California is totally different than driving culture in Colorado, is totally different than driving culture in Maryland. And all three of those states have different automated enforcement laws, different speed laws, different DUI tolerance laws. Congress can sort of dangle a carrot or beat you with a stick, but they can't mandate anything in the same way that you can in somewhere like Sweden or elsewhere.
Yeah, and there's some wide open places in, you know, Montana, the Dakotas, West Texas that, look, you could go 100 miles an hour and nobody cares, except for maybe the pronghorn or the prairie dog or whatever that might be near the road.
Right.
Yeah. What are the latest changes I saw in motorcycle laws here in Colorado? Soon be lane splitting will be allowed, but only if the traffic is basically at a dead stop, right? So, but if traffic is at a dead stop, then where are you going in between cars anyway?
Yeah, so AAA opposed this bill. I'm a motorcyclist, and I would never functionally do it. And I know motorcyclists in California, where it's even more outright legal, and they don't do it because of the considerations. But you're exactly right. So the Colorado General Assembly passed, and the governor signed a sort of moderated proposal on this that requires both lanes to be going the same direction, both lanes to be completely stopped, and allows the motorcyclist to only overtake at 15 miles per hour. Total, they can only go 15 miles per hour, so they're really just puttering along, stops traffic. The thinking being that the motorcyclists don't have to be stuck in congestion if the drivers are, because there's room for the motorcyclists to move around. We oppose the bill because we want there to be the same expectations for all road users. And this, ultimately, we usually use this to protect motorcyclists, where AAA will say the motorcyclist is entitled to the full lane. The motorcyclist should be treated as if it was any other vehicle. All safety laws apply to vehicles as apply to motorcycles. And now we've created this carve-out for them in traffic. We're going to get the word out that this is now the law. I think drivers will be shocked when they see a motorcycle in their rear view coming, you know, inches away from their door in stop traffic. It is a pilot program. This is going to be in law for 3 years. The legislature has to study it. The Department of Transportation has to issue a report on it, seeing if there's an increase in collisions or fatalities, or if it's unsafe for motorcyclists or drivers. And here's what I would say. If you're a motorcyclist and you support this measure, exercise it safely, because all eyes are on you, and let your lawmaker know that you like it. And if you're a driver and you don't like this proposal and it makes you feel unsafe as a driver, let your lawmakers know, because we're just trying this out for 3 years. And then it might become permanent Colorado law, it might not, but they'd have to take another action to do that.
And some of these motorcycles are not skinny like a little dirt bike. They have some size to them, especially if they have a saddlebag on either side. So, I mean, it's a little bit tricky to get, I would think, in between some of these cars, even if they are at a dead stop and somebody might want to change lanes for whatever reason. And it doesn't seem like it's going to be all that safe.
Here's what I would say. Just because something is legal doesn't mean you should do it regularly, often, or even in that one moment. A great example is right on red. It's legal for motorists in many jurisdictions in Colorado to turn right on red. Generally, I advise motorists against doing it just because of the pedestrian and bicyclist risk, your own risk of getting collided into by a car traveling above the speed limit. I don't personally ever take a right on red, even though it's legal. And as a motorcyclist, I would never choose to lane filter, even though it's legal. And it's because of these safety concerns. And look, if you're driving riding a leader bike or a big bike, or you've got saddlebags, or you're probably not going to take this risk. I think we're increasingly going to see probably motorcyclists on smaller vehicles taking advantage of it. But remember, if you break the law, you will be caught. So this is not an opportunity for you to travel 60 miles per hour between lanes of traffic. You can go up to 15 miles per hour. If you think that's really going to shave off a lot of time off your day, okay, you know, avail yourself of it. But you know, be mindful that enforcement will be clear on this one.
I think it's more of a safety thing. So they don't want the motorcyclists don't want to sit behind somebody and stop and go traffic because the person behind them is not paying attention. As we all know, they're looking at their phone and would then run into the motorcyclist or squish them in between another vehicle. So make it a motorcycle sandwich, basically.
That is what the advocate said at the legislature, and I was there, and how I responded was that if we really cared about motorcyclist safety in Colorado, we would pass a primary helmet law. We would do more strict speed enforcement. We would do more strict DUI enforcement. So, yeah, in some situations, will this create a safer environment for motorcyclists? Yes, absolutely. In some situations, will it create a more dangerous situation for motorcyclists? Yes, absolutely. And if we really want to get motorcyclist fatalities under control, we should pass a primary helmet law.
And the same with, you said, the hands-free thing. So it sounds like that is coming down the line here. And do you think that's going to pass here in Colorado? And maybe is it time for a nationwide ban on hands, you know, on devices?
27 states have a handheld ban. Colorado's not one of them. We do have a primary, we have a reckless driving ban related to, but you can't be pulled over just for having your phone out. 27 states, you can be pulled over just because law enforcement can see your phone. I am optimistic it will pass in Colorado. I also think that the way we've engineered this law is really smart this time around. So on your first offense, you will be ticketed for having your phone out, but an affirmative defense for that is to go to the judge and show them a receipt that you bought for a handheld phone, you know, holder. A hands-free device, right, for your vehicle. That counts as an affirmative defense. If you're ticketed again after that, you know, there are penalties, but the goal is not for folks to get pulled over for this. It's for them just not to be holding their phone while they're driving. And look, what I've done since I've been at AAA is I just put my phone in my glove box, and that works for me, and it's kind of therapeutic. I'm unreachable when I'm driving, and that's nice for me, but we need to just change the culture, and that starts with not being okay seeing drivers, because right now this, you know, this is legal. And you're driving, you will see someone driving recklessly and you'll see them holding their phone. They can't really be pulled over for that unless they do something like crossing a lane or something that is just completely noticeable and visible. Now, if the law were to pass, eventually you could be pulled over for this, because this, I think, is inherently reckless.
Yes. And I've tried to really unhinge my or unhook myself from my phone. Here's how much I've done it so far. Today, in fact, I left both of my phones. I have a work phone and a personal phone. I left them both at the TV station before driving to do this interview. So that was 30 minutes in the car without even thinking about not having my phones. And so
you've got to drive 30 minutes back.
Exactly. I will have to do that. But that at least I'm making progress.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, and as much as we all want to do the right thing, you do have to deliberately choose to do it. We know from neurological research and psychological research, basically looking at your phone lit up with a notification gives you this exact same dopamine rush as hitting a good slot on a slot machine. So it's that same, the brain lights up the exact same way when we see a notification. So we are actually becoming addicted to our phones. And that's why you might not even realize you're looking at it when you're driving, but then you are looking at it and then you're distracted. So again, do not disturb while driving mode is great. We recommend motorists use it. And then if you can, just put your phone in the glove box. I, for example, will not be buying a hand-free phone mount for my phone because I already have one. It's called the car, and I just leave the phone in the glove box.
Well, you know, I could talk to you for another hour, but I won't because you're a busy man. Hey, I appreciate all your expert in. I mean, honestly, when I started off the show saying you are an expert extraordinaire, this is the. I mean, this is it. This is the proof right here.
Well, look, it's nice that AAA has, we research everything and we research to death, and I just get to read the reports and then learn a lot. So it's a great place to work.
Skylar McKinley, Regional Director of Public Affairs for AAA Colorado. If people want to get a hold of you or AAA, how do they do that?
Best way to find me is just go to newsroom.acg.aa.com. Click Colorado. You'll get all of my contact information. Again, newsroom.acg.aa.com. That's all the stuff we're working on right now in Colorado and across the country.
And I'll make sure that I had a link in the description of the show for your contact. Skylar, awesome. Again, thanks you so much for your time. Awesome stuff. Appreciate it.
Talk to you soon and stay safe out there.
Again, Skylar's contact information is in the description of the show. And yes, he is spokesperson extraordinaire. He is a natural at what he does and could work for a much larger company. He could run AAA, he could run the whole thing, I think. But I mean, their whole communications department. He could work for politicians as a spokesperson. But I really think he likes where he is right now, and the quality of life is a big thing. And I'm sure he's been offered other jobs, bigger jobs. I've been offered other jobs and bigger jobs, but I stay where I am because of quality of life. And I'm relatively sure the TV station likes what I do, and I'm happy doing it. But we all know what happens when you start counting those unhatched chickens, right? thanks again to Skylar for spending the time. I could spend 2 hours. We could do two, I was thinking about breaking this thing up into two different episodes, or just having Skylar on again for another thing. But anyway, there it is. So enjoy. Anyway, thanks again for being here. And until next time, I'm Jason Luber, the traffic guy. Be safe. And as always, happy motoring.